Okay, so here we are for the module 5 discussion. Oh, I should close that door. There. You don't really need the local news in the background as we're doing this. It's just local news. And still nobody else in the
I have to fess up that this week has been a completely disconnected week, so I would benefit from the discussion, but mostly by listening.
I think it's been like that for most people, and it also includes myself, oddly enough, although I really have basically done nothing this week but work on the course. But I don't know if I'm really getting the outputs to show for that. But how about you, Mark? How did this week go for you?
Well, it was normal, slightly connected.
Slightly connected, okay.
But did you see my email less than an hour ago?
I did.
So I part of the disconnection was the activity center page
Yeah.
not updating. So there was a couple days going, "Oh, Stephen's busy," in the video. And then yesterday I found two videos more than an hour long. So
Yeah.
I watched the long one,
Oh,
and
yeah.
actually I'm editing the text for the virtue one.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I'll send that to you once I get it cleaned up. No,
Oh.
because it appears, at least on YouTube, it appears in the chat,
Yeah.
right? And you can turn off the timestamps, so it has a column of timestamps, which until I figured out you can turn those off, it was really annoying to edit out. But
Yeah.
you can turn them off. So then you get all these lines and join the lines, but there's no punctuation and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna clean it up into a readable text, and I'll send it to you.
Okay, now you do know that I'm also putting up transcripts, right, of these, so there's also that transcript. I don't know if that helps or not. I didn't know that
That's
YouTube was
what
creating.
I'm talking about, actually.
Oh,
Well,
okay.
I'm talking about the YouTube transcript, which appears in the chat. I haven't looked for, is there a Zoom transcript, or you're posting the separate transcript from your phone, or you're waiting
Yeah,
for the
it's a
phone?
separate transcript from the phone. It's not taken from
Oh.
the YouTube.
I haven't found those.
That's interesting because I didn't know YouTube was doing transcripts of them.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a new thing to
Yeah.
Zoom. So
Yeah.
it appears in the chat, but it's broken into time stamps,
Yeah.
like every second. So it's not
So
very useful.
you can see the other ones. Let me just quickly pop into the course here and I'll show you. And then of course showing you and showing everybody who's in the course. Okay, let's just very quickly. I'll just share the screen here if I can remember how to do it. There we go. And there we go. All right, so if you're in the course, you can see all the presentations, assuming the page updates. And again, yeah, it hasn't updated the last two. Let me just do that manually. Like I say, I'm having update issues with my pages, and it's since the beginning of the course, and it has been incredibly annoying. So I'll list page, and so I have to update everything manually, and you can see there's lots of pages, and it's just something I haven't been able to get up on. So this is course videos, right? Yeah. Which is really the list of course presentations. So I'll just publish that page. There we go. Now, there we go. So if we look at the one on duty, which by the way, I was pretty pleased with. So here's the presentation. You see the video here, the slides are here. You can just step through the slides. You can also listen to the alternative audio recording here. And then down here are the links to the slides, audio, video, and also to the transcript. Right.
And see, I usually just jump to YouTube, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Oh, excellent.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's better or worse than the YouTube transcript. They're both being produced by the same company, which is Google. But,
right.
You know, one is by YouTube and the other is from Google Recorder, and who knows?
And did you clean up that transcript?
No. Haven't had time to do any of that at all.
Oh, so it comes with paragraphs and capitalization?
It comes with paragraphs and capitalization, though. Yeah. It's not perfect by any stretch, but, you know, having something like that is better, way better than nothing.
Oh, yeah, this is way better than the YouTube version.
Okay.
So I'll finish cleaning up that text, and then I'll send it to you if you want to merge them or compare them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That would be so cool. Because, you know, what I'm planning to do, I've been creating transcripts of all the sessions that I've been doing, and including our sessions with you, me, Sharita, and anyone else who joins us, although it's been basically you guys. And after the course, my plan is to clean up all the transcriptions, assemble them into a single large document. It'll be basically a book-length document, and then that's the outcome of this course, for me anyways. But you guys are obviously valuable participants in the creation of that. Because, you know, we have these interactive sessions, and then I'm thinking about these interactive sessions when I'm doing those other videos. So there's this thing, this bouncing back and forth of ideas that's happening. So, I keep feeling guilty because, you know, just recording videos isn't really anyone's idea of a good online course. But it's been such a valuable activity for me that I've been spending a lot of time doing that. Mm-hmm. So I hope you're getting something out of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and the thinking out loud part is a different modality. I mean, it is. And so I think you should foreground that when you assemble whatever the output is.
Yeah.
Foreground that, and that's what we're doing on Mondays and Fridays. We're thinking out loud.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then there's the other, and I'm finding this interesting too, the MOOC aspect to it. Now, because it's a connectivist MOOC, it's this distributed associative system which emulates a lot of the properties of artificial intelligence. It isn't AI, of course, but you know, we're sort of modeling the way a lot of AI would work, and then that's feeding back into it as well, which was my other big thing that I did this week. And I'm not sure if you saw it, because it only showed up in the newsletter on Wednesday as like test page. But let me show you what I've done. Okay. So here we go. We'll go back in.
I remember seeing that. I don't remember if I clicked on it.
Yeah. No, you probably didn't, because I haven't highlighted it, and it's, you know, test page isn't exactly an inviting thing, but it always hides the top of my browser window when I do that. Okay, so here's the page that I created. So remember before we were doing graphs like this, right? Now imagine two rows of graphs, right? So on the left-hand side here, you'd have all the different codes, and then on the right-hand side here, you'd have all the different values. Now the way we were doing it, we'd draw lines. Awkward, cumbersome, really visually nice, but awkward and cumbersome to do. So here, as the train goes by. Instead of drawing a line, you just check a box. So if you check a box here, for example, that's like drawing a line between the IEEE Code of Ethics and CARE. And this is more like how people think of AI that are in AI, right? You have this matrix. These things here are vectors. You can have the vectors down and the vectors across. And then they do a whole bunch of, you know, if you look at the courses and whatever on artificial intelligence, they do a whole lot of manipulation of these matrices. And a lot of AI constitutes matrix mathematics. Because really, like, we've got one matrix in between each of these sets, right? You know, like autonomy, well, each of these values, sets of values in each of these codes. But in an AI system, you might have 2, 3, 4, whatever, interconnected matrices. So you have the code at the one end, and then a couple layers of these things all densely connected, and then the value at the other end, and the AI basically fills in all of those squares. And they do that using matrix mathematics, for lack of a better term. Do I understand all of the matrix mathematics that they do? No. because, and it's, I find this really interesting. You know, I took all the mathematics courses from kindergarten all the way through and into university, first year university. Matrix functions never came up. So I never did addition of matrices, multiplication of matrices, etc. Never did anything like that. But there's this whole branch of mathematics that addresses it. So for me to understand that, for most people to understand, you know, the actual details of artificial intelligence, you have to go back and cover that mathematics, that your foundational education covering all the basics never covered. So to me, that's an interesting thing. But anyhow, the idea is, right, you click on these boxes. Now, I want to do so a little helpful display so that if you click on the name of the code, you get a display of the code here. Or if you click on the name of the value, you get a display of the value. So you know what you're connecting. But anyhow, once you do that, I also want to have ways of subdividing these lists because it's a bit hard to work with. But anyhow, you click, go down to the bottom, you submit your graph values. And so here are the graph elements that I submitted. And now that actually is now stored in the database. And that actually works, but I don't have a mechanism for displaying that yet. But that's like a short job to do, assuming it actually went into the graph the way it should. So that's the other thing I did. And what I wanted that to be was a task for this week, but it took me more than one day to write what you've seen so far, and so I wasn't able to finish that task. It's been that kind of week. A good week, because, you know, I think that was interesting, but still. So what do you think about that? What are your thoughts?
I like the way you were saying that, how you might work this even further out would be to have, you know, the particular code, if you clicked on, you know, I don't know, the code of psychologists, yeah, right? And then you could read that, and then you could click along the top in terms of exactly the meanings. And that would be an interesting way, if I had it like that, to, you know, begin to click. We don't have it like that. However, I do have multiple monitors.
Yeah, so that helps.
That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Right? And take a look at that. That should be fun. It probably will not make me as frustrated as drawing the lines that I was really, you know.
Yeah.
However, Melcher, what's his first name?
Matthias. Matthias Melcher, yeah.
He did, message me, and I actually found not the demo,
mm-hmm.
but the actual thing. So I'm beginning to play a bit with that.
Yeah, his actual thing is very powerful. It's in Java.
Yeah.
So, and my hatred of Java is legendary. love JavaScript, but Java, just it's like using a battleship to... go fishing. and he's been thinking about this for a very long time, and he's also helped me out. I've been in communication with him on how to use this, and I think that it would what I want to do, and again, this is not too far away as far as actual work goes now. Once you've done all of those squares, you can display the result using his system, and it will look pretty cool because you'll see all the lines, right? Because it's all the same data. It's just two different ways of representing that data and inputting that data. But the other thing, too, is it doing it this way allows me to ask some interesting questions. For example, one question might be, how would I come up with the things to actually connect? Because that's a relevant question, right? Like, I've connected codes and values with this one. I've connected other things with some of the other ones, right? But codes and values. Well, how am I... the codes are fairly obvious, there's an actual document, but the values are kind of nebulous. How am I picking out and naming these values and defining these values? What's that process, right? Because that's something that's actually that's an input to our AI system, but it's just me making it up.
Right.
Well, I'm not really making it up, but you know what I mean. So the way this was done in the Fjeld paper that I distributed to you guys in the newsletter was that they actually studied the ethical codes, identified the values that were mentioned in the codes, and listed those. And that, in fact, is the same process that I used. And it makes sense because, we're mapping values to codes. We might as well extract the values from the codes in order to create that matching. It's probably a bit easier that way. But, does the list of ethical codes comprehend the list of all possible values? And again, what terminology should I use? I mean, these, I think, are interesting questions.
Mm-hmm.
And suppose, this is a different question, suppose we were a machine, or maybe designing a machine, that actually indicates whether we should connect a code with a value. What process should we use? And think about how we do it. Well, I mean, we're going to have to, as you said, Shweta, go back and look at the original, which is why it's so useful to have it sitting right there. So the code says this, the value is this, and we're doing some kind of mental matching task. But what exactly is that process? If I wanted to write a piece of software to do that matching instead of do it personally, because it's going to take a long time... how would I write it? So I could just do simple keyword matching.
Yeah.
But that presumes that everybody writing all of these ethical codes use the same vocabulary and mean the same words in the same way. And what are the odds of that? Maybe within the discipline of ethics and AI, sure. But, I got codes from legal professions, teaching, journalism, psychology, medicine. odds seem pretty slim there. So there's, you know, there's quite a bit of interpretation happening for me to pick the labels in the first place, and then quite a bit of interpretation happening in doing the association. So simple keyword mapping isn't really going to do the job. And so one of almost the fundamental question of AI, certainly approaching it this way, is what would do the job?
Mm-hmm.
And that is a core question. And I'm not going to try to offer an answer to that here, because that's like all of AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like Sharita's idea of having the text, and I implied that you meant that you could have the text and then click the value category so that you don't have to scroll down all the front, right? That's okay.
Yeah.
That's what I heard. That would be very useful. I also have, you know, gave up mathematics after one class in college.
So did I.
Yeah, well, it's not necessary to go farther in most. And certainly I use math in my career, but what I had was enough. Anyway, but I am interested in graphing, and what is not going on, and this is what the issue I want to bring up, is the weights or the definitions of the connections.
Yeah.
That's another level, and that, I mean, that's back to Charles Peirce. I mean, that's, you know, it's the, one of the original parts of graphing is that the connections have meaning themselves.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, first of all, does AI use that? Does AI do that? And can we do that?
Short answer to both questions is yes. AI definitely does that.
That's what I assumed, but yeah. I didn't know.
Yeah, and that's a big part of what these algorithms do, is adjust the weights of the connections. Like in this graph, it's just off or on, right? Which is nice, but again, it's too ham-fisted, really. You know, one code might talk about a value a lot and really depend on it. Another code might just sort of mention it in passing. And you don't want to give them both a weight of one. And so part of the processing that an AI does is to adjust these weights. And that is, you know, that's one of the things that's made possible in part by having multiple layers in between the codes and the values, right? If you have multiple connected layers, you can really do some fine-tuning of those weights, and get very good results. And again, that's what AI does. What I've done is, in my code, each one of these associations does have a weight. So I have like the table, the first element, right? So code number 17, and then the second element, value number 5, and then the type of connection between them, and I'm just assigning the name user, right? And then the weight. And what I'm doing is each time a user adds that connection, I increment the weight by one. So that way I can use the same graph with a large number of people, and if a lot of people pick that particular square, the number is higher.
And so it's weighted more.
It's weighted more, yeah. Okay. And then you represent that, like in the grid thing, I can represent it with smaller or bigger dots. Or in the graphical representation, I could represent it with thinner or fatter lines, although I don't know how to do that with Matthias's system. I'm not sure if it's possible. Presumably it is. Because, you know, I mean, he uses, for the JavaScript anyways, he uses an element called canvas in HTML. It's a very flexible piece of HTML. Most people don't even know it exists. But it does exist, and you can draw all kinds of things with canvas. So I'm sure I could widen or narrow the weight, the lines based on the weights.
So I was also wondering about semantic weights.
Yeah.
That's another order of complexity that I'm sure.
Okay, what do you mean by semantic weights?
Well, one of them is the name user, right? You're collecting user, which is not, you're counting it, so you're determining it as a mathematical property.
Yep.
But it could be a semantic property, the name of the user. And then, again, I'm thinking of back to first, I only read about graphs, so I don't build them. But there could be semantic connections also. You know, they could be semantic representation of the weights, you know, so it could be more of a counting, like strong or weak.
Yeah.
But it could also be, comes from the church, comes from law,
right?
Comes from ethical code.
Okay.
Those kind of, you know, so you can see it's much more complex, but somehow it relates to AI, right? But theoretically, a computer can handle that. Yeah. And then again, it's how you make this work. Would almost take a human.
So part of what I'm doing that addresses this is naming the type of connection, right? So for take any two entities, we draw an association between them. That association has a weight, but I also give it a name. And I think the name maybe captures in part the semantic aspect of what you're thinking. So I could have, now I'm just calling these user connections because they were created by users. You know, if I'm using a different analytical approach, I could say, you know, I could do semantically like something is a part of something or belongs to or is a type of. And there's the whole range of relations that are defined in the semantic web, in the world of RDF. It's called Resource Description Framework, and they allow for all of these different types of connections to form, you know, semantic meaning. I don't go full-blown RDF, although I could. I think the RDF a label set is limited, because I think the relations are not simply semantical. They can be almost anything, right? And the way I've built Grasshopper is you can name the connection whatever you want, which makes it a lot more flexible. That's something you just don't see anywhere. But it's in there in the software.
Theoretical.
Yeah, well, it exists and is buried there inside the software. It's just it just never comes up in any of the applications of it because it's hard to do. The other aspect is that let's pick the values. The values aren't just related to the codes. They could be related to other things. So, like, for example, this week we've been looking at the different ethical theories. We'll not finished that by any stretch. And I'm thinking maybe I'll delay the week, but that's a separate issue. So we have, you know, we have duty-based theories, and there's a bunch of them. We have virtue-based theories, and there's a bunch of them. So we could do the same exercise. We could look at these values and ask ourselves, well, what ethical theory or what ethical tradition are they associated with? And now we've got something kind of interesting because we have, you know, via this two-step linking, a way of thinking about how the ethical codes are related to the ethical theory, but not just directly related, but via the values represented. And so that's kind of a way of thinking about it. We could also directly relate them, right? But I'm not sure that would be as easy.
And there's one more thing I wanted to bring up while we're still talking about connection.
Yep.
In Diaz's system, there's no undo button. And so I know I introduced some error by because of where the labels
are in the box,
right? You understand?
Yeah.
So that just, you know, that brings up the issue of error. I introduced some errors because I could not undo.
Mm-hmm.
I could only add, realizing my mistake, I could only add another connection.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that once the display's cleaned up, then that goes away. But the error is reduced. But there's always going to be error. So,
there's always going to be error. I agree.
Right.
I'd rather the way I'd like it all to work is the error stays over there on your website, but there's always going to be error. One of the great things about this kind of approach, though, is that the error almost factors out. It creates noise in the system, but the system can stand noise. So let's take a good example. Suppose you created an ethical code by accident. It's not really an ethical code, but you put in something that you thought you were putting in the right thing, but it went into ethical codes. It's not a code, but there it is in the database and you can't remove it. Well, okay. It's not like people aren't going to check the box related to that ethical code because they're not going to find a relation between what you wrote and the value, right? So already we're beginning to see it abstracted out a bit. As well, each of these things, right, each value, each ethical code, each ethical theory, can also have a weight. Just like the connections, the individual entities can have weights. And over time, the weight of the one that you made as a mistake would be very low. But the other things, which get mentioned a lot and used a lot and connected a lot, those weights will be higher. So again, even though you made a mistake, and even though you can't remove it from the system, even though it's noise in the data, in the grand scheme of thing, it doesn't carry very much weight, and it's mostly just ignored by the whole rest of the system.
Yeah, this is the we just need more data approach.
It's the we just need more data, and
which you hear so often, and you know, and there you just pointed out why that is a true statement.
Yeah,
from a certain point of view.
Yeah, and I'm tempted, you know, like we don't have thousands of people in the course, but that's okay. I'm tempted to just take, you know, one of these grids once it's done and has all the little displays, pop that on Twitter and see if people just fill in that grid.
Mm-hmm.
No, they might not. It's, I have a limited following on Twitter. You know, I'm not Twitter famous, so, you know, I'm not going to get hundreds of responses for sure, but probably get more than one or two, I think. I know.
Which knows? Almost double your data set.
Which would double my data set. Yeah.
So,
can I ask a question?
Yeah.
As I keep coming back to the entity that develops, I'm going to say code, but I really think the bias of the entity
mm-hmm.
that tries to put this all together.
Yeah.
Now, most of the codes that I'm reading really are, you know, in some ways based on Western thought.
Yep.
So what happens if that entity that is going to program this or whatever sets it up not to weight things as a Western ethic.
Yeah.
So what happens then?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, it depends on how you go about doing that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how would you go about setting it up not to weight things based on Western values?
Mm-hmm.
You know, now, what a lot of people are talking about is, well, you just get opinions from different populations in the data. So the equivalent in our system would be, I take my grid,
yeah,
right, and I don't just show it to Western academics or their, you know, first year psychology students, which is what we usually do in education. I take that grid and I make it available specifically to people in different cultures. And indeed, if I wanted to be really careful, when people filled in that grid, they would also record maybe what their language is, religion, culture, background, etc., which would feed in as well to the system, so that when I calculated the weight of these connections, I could, instead of just taking a numerical average, I can take a representative average where each religion is weighted equally, or so I could do that, and that's the sort of thing that people do.
Okay.
But isn't making a grid a Western approach by definition, and showing a grid in a lot of cultures, mm-hmm. it would be like, I don't know, it would be meaningless.
Okay, now, there's two ways of looking at that. But, I mean, that's a great question, right? The first way is, okay, maybe it's just an interface problem, right? Grids are pretty square, pretty Western. Maybe if you had something less, with fewer pointy corners. The graphs sort of help with that, you know. Or, you know, you could sort of represent things as gradients. And, you know, you can imagine all kinds of different interfaces where...
Emojis.
Pardon?
Emojis instead of text.
Emojis instead of text. You know, just all kinds of things like that. You know, I'm just picturing in my mind like a completely analog interface where people are just using their fingers on a touch screen,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that might be more appropriate for some culture. I have no idea what kind of interface is appropriate for what kind of culture. There was an NRC study years ago that tried to associate different color palettes with different cultures. I'm not sure what came of that, and I'm not sure if you can. But certainly we can imagine that intuitively, and we know that different colors represent different things in different cultures. You know, like the color white, for example, means something very different in our culture than it would, say, in Chinese culture. So, you know, the other part is, what if the whole idea of breaking things down into parts and associating them is itself a Western idea?
It is. It's reductionist.
Right. And you know, and you know, you look at how I've structured this entire course here, right? And like, only an old English guy from an analytical tradition would take a subject like ethics and analytics and break it all down into little pieces the way I've done it. Like, who would do that other than someone like me? And there's a point to that. I agree there's a point to that. And then the question, and it's not just an ethical question, but it is an ethical question, but it's also a methodological question. What do you do instead?
Yeah.
All right. And I think that's a good question. Where I hit up against it, again, because my culture is kind of different from the classic analytical Western philosopher researcher kind of mold, is to distinguish between symbolic elements and sub-symbolic elements. A symbolic element is a word, right? It might include an emoji, but it's a representational system. The word, the title I've given to a value or to an ethical code or to whatever, stands for something. So basically, we're manipulating symbol systems. I think words are blunt instruments completely unsuited to the task, because you just capture too much with a word. Pick any word you want. Cup. Here's a cup, right? Our understanding of a cup is much more nuanced than the word could possibly convey. And if we look at our minds, how we have the concept cup in our brain, we do have, you know, the physical symbol and the audio symbol cup that we can use, right? We can hear somebody say cup and we can say the word cup. But we don't have the word cup in our brain anywhere. And we don't even have a physical image of a cup in our brain. But what we have is several thousand neurons that go whenever we see one of these. And that prompts us to associate this with the word cup. Or it does for me. Might not for you.
One of the unfortunate attributes of dangerous language is its flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you picked the word cup, not me.
Yep.
But so I can say, wow, I hope that football player was wearing his cup when he took that hit.
Yep. And you don't mean one of these.
I do not.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, it's murky. We're swimming around in the murky deep end here.
Yep.
Of trying to make meaning. I mean, that's what we're doing, I think. And discussing how machines could make meaning.
Mm-hmm.
My skepticism has grown as we've done this, but that's not going to stop people from trying.
No,
so
shouldn't stop you from trying. Doesn't stop me from trying. And I got more skepticism than you can shake a stick at. I love metaphors. Metaphors adds a whole other dimension to this.
Oh yeah.
You know. So. If we're trying to do AI and we're trying to avoid bias, we're kind of stuck with the fact that any system of language, any labeling system, is going to have some kind of bias.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So for me, what that says is, well, ultimately, we should probably eliminate that layer from AI. But that's kind of hard.
Mitigation was the word used. I think it was Monday whenever we were talking about this.
Yep. Not a coincidence.
And so, somewhere along here, you convinced me that elimination is impossible. So that's why I reached for mitigation.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we would have to. I would want. I should make it personally. I would want absolute transparency. So open source. So that the code could be critiqued from multiple points of view, and then mitigation would be part of the ongoing discussion because the stuff evolves. That's another issue.
The stuff evolves. The word
is designed to evolve. I mean, yes. Yeah. So this mitigation problem is going to increase as it evolves, right? The idea of mitigation is going to also grow and grow more complex as the AI grows and grows more complex.
Yeah.
It's going to be a wicked problem.
Yeah. But also, too, I mean, let's bring this back to education for a second, especially since we're running to the end of our hour. But a lot of educational processes and a lot of educational theory is inherently based around the idea of labeling. Think about how many theories are taxonomies of this and categorizations of that, right? They're all based on labeling. Or alternatively, think about the work that's going on right now to develop systems for recognizing and teaching skills and competencies, where what they're trying to do is create this competency definition taxonomy with the idea that everybody would use the same taxonomy. It's a labeling thing, right? What you're doing is taking all of this raw data, which is subsymbolic and very nuanced and out there in the world and partially in our own brains, and trying to associate it with a bunch of words. And then later on, we'll try to use these words to, say, evaluate a test or a performance or something like that. So we've built in this structural bias into our system that maybe we could have avoided by skipping the part where we categorize everything. Maybe. Of course, the problem is, how would we understand what we've done without language to describe it?
Yeah, interpretive dance only goes so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know, at some point, somebody's going to have to sit down and say, well, when we see this motion, what the dancer means is that the moon is full and she is filled by the moon. We bring it back into language. But, of course, nobody listening to that would say, oh, the moon, she's filled with the moon? She's way too small. The moon is huge. So, of course, now we're in metaphor land.
One of the issues I run into all the time in higher education, for some reason, well, it's part of the system. This naming, reaching.
Hello.
Yep.
And so,
hi, sweetie.
The one thing I wanted to bring up, is also beyond the cultural lens, you know, that we've been discussing. It's just been, I've really been struck with this last couple weeks in this class and in my regular college online class. And there's that word class, you know, used multiple ways. Yeah. So all of this AI, not only is it, you know, Western, educated, mostly men, probably mostly white. Well, although the coding part is spreading around. Not only is it, you know, that particular point of view, but also class comes into this. That this is all created and embedded inside of capitalism. So this is all taking place inside of capitalism. It's all done by a particular class, and it's being paid for by the upper portions of the class, and in my opinion, is being used against the lower classes. However you want to define it.
Yep. And that's an argument that can certainly be made. And, you know, I mean, we might call it, say, critical class theory, and it's analogous to critical race theory. You know, and you do see that kind of argument made by people like Marx and Engels 150 years ago. Very
but
similar
not
sorts
in
of arguments.
Contemporary higher education.
Well, it depends on where you are. You know, it really does depend on where you are. I mean, there's no shortage of class-based thought out there in the world. Unfortunately, a lot of it is propagated by people who are in the upper class. And so there's a certain skewed perspective of it. But it exists. But let me challenge you with this now. That also is a label. Right? And we... You know, I mean, it's not for no reason that people like Marx used basically what were almost artificial words like bourgeoisie and proletariat to describe what he's talking about, because, you know, it's just hard to express those concepts in the language that was in common use. And even today it's kind of, you know, I mean, we talk about the working class, right? But we include in the working class a lot of people who aren't, strictly speaking, working. You know, if they're unemployed, for example. What we mean by the working class is probably delineated by their circumstances, by where they live, what size house, if they have a house or apartment they live, what their income is. And as you alluded to earlier, also their values, their belief set, etc. And it would be interesting, I think, to draw one of these maps that we've been drawing from values to different classes of people. And it'd be interesting to see not just an overall graph, but how people in their different classes drew that graph. But again, how do you label it? You know, there are almost certainly values, as we've been using the term, that exist in the working class that other classes might not even have a word for. You know, think about the use of the word righteous in motorcycle clubs. Totally different meaning from the word righteous among people in the British peerage system, right? Just totally different. You know, so there is, but the idea here, I don't know if it flies, but the idea here is if you get enough input and enough of these graphs and you think of these words, these symbols, just as placeholders, but actually not actually as representations of anything. They're just the actual symbols people use. And you get enough data, then maybe you can get past the bias of labeling. Maybe.
See, I bring this up again. I'm the American here.
Yep.
And this is a very important issue.
Oh, yeah.
And part of the reason I'm spending the time, you know, these weeks, is this is such an important issue in American politics because of American corporations' influence, the people that build AI, Google, Facebook, the largest application of AI, are having really deleterious consequences in this culture, or across these cultures, in this territory, if we want to use that word. And so that's why I bring these things up, is because it's actually a pressing issue that's not getting solved. It's not going to be solved by the next election, which is in 1 year from now. And these are the issues that should be discussed in the newspaper every day and on the radio every day, and they're not.
And just to give you an example of that, in the thing that I did on duty, which I just did yesterday, and again, I'm very proud of it. Maybe proud is the wrong word, but pleased with it. There's a section in it on autonomy, which is what you need in order to make ethical decisions as a free agent. And the question is just how autonomous are we in fact? You know, especially when you think that, you know, all of these labels, all of these words that we use do have a built-in bias, and then all of the media that we're exposed to that, you know, underline and enforce that bias, when we, as a free agent, express an ethical opinion, are we actually doing so autonomously, or are we, in a very serious way, simply reflecting back the bias that's been fed into us? And that's a core question. You know, that's one of these questions, and that's why the ethics of artificial intelligence is so important, because it also comes back to the ethics of complex systems like society. And, you know, we think about biased input for an AI, but we've got biased input for a society as well. But how do you tag that bias? How do you put a finger on that bias when the very use of words themselves incorporates bias? And that's a hard problem. Like a really super duper hard problem.
Do you know George? I'm sorry. Do you know George Lakoff?
Yeah.
So he's been working on this, you know, it's kind of his career.
Yeah.
And I also think of, I don't speak French, Jacques Ellul.
Yeah.
Propaganda, the formation of men's part, formation of attitudes.
Yeah.
And that's what you're talking about.
Yep.
And that also is a wicked problem. I'm the only person I know that when I left home at age 17, I never owned a television.
Mm-hmm.
And I say often to people, you should stop watching television, or you know, you should not, you know, because what you said, I hear something coming out of their mouth that I know they heard on television or on talk radio. And so I ask people, is that your thought? Why do you think that, you know? But people don't like it when you do that. So.
I went for many, many years without a television. Like from the day I left home to, I don't know, maybe 30, something like that. I forget how old I was when I finally got one. You can look at people who watch television and see the influence. And so, you know, they're being, I don't want to say programmed, because that's not the right word, trained. Which is maybe a better word. In the same way we train AIs, we use television to train people. And that speaks directly to the subject of learning and development and courses and schools, and that, you know, people try to say, well, you can't teach people using video. Well, tell advertisers that. Anyhow, I think we're going to leave it here because it is 1 o'clock and I don't want to go over time. But this was an interesting discussion and definitely related to this week's topic, because, you know, this does tie back into these ethical theories. But I'll continue developing that grid, and, you know, it's generalized so I can use it with some of the other data sets that we have. And if you think of, and this is useful, different sets of labels we can use to describe whatever let me know, because we can. One of the things that my system has that pretty much no other system does is we can build these on the fly. We can build them from scratch. Doesn't matter what they are. You know, if we want to build a category of items called FUFAs, we can. Nothing prevents us from building them and then linking them into the entire grid graph network that is this course. I don't know how FUFAs would be useful, but that's why I'm asking for your input. You know, maybe there are things that, you know, sets of entities that we should be thinking about that aren't here yet. Okay, so till next time, thanks for popping by. I hope you're finding this interesting still. And I know it's completely wrapping me up, so... and to the point where I'm expecting phone calls, you know, since, you know, come back to work. Anyhow, I'll talk to you all later.
Okay. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, you too. So that was Mark Wilson, Sharita Ryan, and Stephen Downs in conversation for ethics, analytics, and the duty of care. That was for the people listening on audio. Bye, everyone.
Bye.